Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with author and TTRPG designer Jess Levine, who is the creator of games like I Have the High Ground, Planet Fist, and Going Rogue, which is finally coming to print via Kickstarter, happening right now as part of a two-game collaboration with Riley Rethel titled Galactic and Going Rogue. Jess, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
It's lovely to be here. I'm a huge fan of the show, so it's like really, really exciting.
Thank you so much. We're a huge fan of you. We're honored
to have you be here.
Thank you.
I feel like I first discovered your games because of Eye of the High Ground, but then not too long ago, you wrote I literally have it right here, for the Rogue Anthem Soul Muppet Orbital Blues collection. You wrote a module that you sent me a while ago, and it really blew my hair back. I really loved, and it has the most tragic character in the fucking world in it.
Oh, Freddy is so sad. I won't spoil his plotline for anyone who wants to play.
Freddy is so sad, but if anyone hasn't already seen it, Hard Suit Hold Up on the Hartwell Limited is so good, and I think about it all the time.
A lot of alliteration there.
So Jess, we're so excited to talk to you today. We want to kind of get into how your work, you know, touches on adaptation a lot. We want to talk about the beloved game, I Have the High Ground, and of course the current huge Kickstarter that you've got going for Going Rogue and Galactic. But first, I kind of want to start with a question that will help guide us through this whole conversation, which is, how do you think being a true fan of something makes you a better designer?
Oh, okay. Yes, absolutely. So something I like to say with adaptational media is that, like, you have to really love the thing. For the listener, if you're not familiar with that term, I first saw it on Co-host, rest in peace. Media that is trying to take a different piece of media and bring it to a new medium, a new format, right? And Going Rogue is very heavily inspired by Andor and by Star Wars. And so when you're doing adaptational media, which all of my games are in a form, I'll get back there, you have to really love the thing, because your genuine love for that is going to come through. And I'll answer that more because that's your question. But you also have to hate the thing, and that they both have to be genuine.
That's so real.
Yeah. You have to love the thing because the people need to see your enthusiasm. If there is this ironic detachment or whatever, like, they're going to feel that. It's not going to be exciting. Your passion for it doesn't come through. But if you don't hate the thing, all you're going to do is repeat the thing, but slightly worse because it's not really the thing. You have to have an argument that you want to be having with that text, with that thing. And that is what's going to make it a unique and interesting version of that of that original media. Like, even if that changes it, that's going to make it way more compelling, because it's going to make it feel, instead of like the, like, low-budget animation knockoff of a Pixar movie, it's going to feel like a spiritual sequel. So both. But being a true fan, I do think it takes both, right? Because everyone also has something different. And the co-host post I was thinking of, Rip again, said this really well. Everyone experiences a piece of media differently. Everyone has different elements of that media that stand out to them as what is important about it. And when they make that game or that adaptation in general, you're going to see what piece of it they really care about. And that part's going to shine. And so you have to have that thing, and you have to know what that thing is in yourself. And so, like, when Riley made Galactic, the tagline for Galactic, which is like adapting the mainline Star Wars trilogies in a lot of ways, the tagline for that game is Rebellion, Relationships, and War Among the Stars. And that's because the core of what Riley loves about Star Wars is the relationships, is the way it is so grounded in these character relationships, which, like, every good piece of fiction is, but not every adaptation of Star Wars is grounded in the relationships between characters. And you can play different Star Wars games and what have you and be getting very different things than that out of it. But it's so core to what Riley loved and to the story. But that is Riley's version. That is Riley's emphasis. And it comes through in the game. There's a reason almost every playbook has an X as one of their possible relationships, right? Because, like, that is the story Riley is trying to tell. And with Going Rogue, the whole reason it came into existence is because I loved Galactic. I became obsessed with it. It was like my pandemic lockdown coping mechanism. And the game that I played, we wrote 150,000 words of short fiction in about 6 months about the characters outside of the sessions that we were playing, the four of us together, Seda, Rhiannon, Bree, and I. We're so into it. But Riley announced a game jam for it, and I realized Rogue One was my favorite Star Wars movie, still is. I love it. And Galactic wasn't built to tell those stories because it was built to tell the things that Riley was most excited about from the trilogies, which was those like charming but flawed heroes having these relational struggles. And that sort of gritty drama of Rogue One was not really built into that system. So I was like, what if I take the core mechanics of this and make it be able to tell the other type of story I really like in Star Wars? And so me having a different aspect of that franchise and those particular movies that I wanted to focus on is why we got what started as an expansion and then became its really whole own game. Like, I realized you couldn't actually fully combine what Riley was doing and the vision that I had for this thing and get them to work together, even though they're adapting the same franchise. And so I know I've gone like way off your question, but that is part of what I think it means to be a true fan and how that helps with adaptational media is that you have to have that thing in the universe that makes you really crazy about it. And then you have to focus on that thing because you are the only one who loves that part of it that much.
I love that framing of it of, because I can think of like pieces of media where I feel like this, where like, I love this thing so much and I'm so mad at them for fucking up this part of it. And I'm like, and then it's only a half step later where it's like, I can fix that. and then you're like, okay, great. This moment in this thing that I love that didn't get its due, let's crank that up to 100. You know, let's really pull the lever on that thing and see what the story looks like and see what the world looks like through that very specific lens. I really like that framing of it.
So I feel that way about like everything that I watch, but Star Wars especially like gets me in that way of like, I could fix this and I want to.
I can fix him. I can fix him. I swear.
I really can. I really can. Galactic is that too from Riley, right? Like one of the things, obviously we're not using any Disney IP. Disney, go away. And so Riley likes to say that she filed the serial numbers off. So we have a Liberation and a Mandate who are fighting. We have the space between, the mystical force that connects all things. And Riley and I both think it sucks that the Jedi are child kidnapping sexless ascetics who say that there is only one way to interact with this force that is, it's either good or it's bad if you have emotions and attachments and you should deny and repress. Yeah, that sucks. And so Riley's space between, like setting element pillar, gets to like push on that and present alternate visions of that. And even better, people at the table get to do that. And it's something we encourage in the book is like, what do you not like about Star Wars? Okay, cool. We've set up a framework to give you the bones of what we think you will need to tell this type of story. But we've also given you a framework to choose how is yours going to be different. Each of the like setting elements in the game, which is the belonging outside belonging parlance. These are coming from the system made by Avery Alder and Benjamin Rosenbaum in Dream Askew, Dream Apart. You have to choose desires for each of these things. What does the Liberation want? What does the Mandate want? Do they want an end to the Nova Jedi? Or do they want dominion over the space between? Is it all gone so they're not questioned? Or is it they are the only ones who get to control how the space between gets used? Which, by the way, that's exactly what the Jedi do. So, but that's in the Mandate pillar now because they because it sucks. Because Riley had a thing that she wanted to argue with, and then also wants to give it to players to have their own arguments with. And then when I was developing Going Rogue, I love Rogue One. I love it so much. The game is in many ways a love letter to Cassian Andor, which, by the way, started this game before the Andor show was out. I think even announced. I watched that movie. I love that character. I'm like number one lesbians for Cassian Andor fan club. I hate Jyn Erso. I hate the protagonist of that movie. And I should love her. I should. She is a character who was like a childhood freedom fighter who, like, working with Saw Gerrera, who says, like, fuck the most liberal elements of the council who runs this thing. We're going to do this mission. We're going to make this happen. Who, like, doesn't have to have a heterosexual love interest in the movie. Thank God. Like, I should be a sucker for this character. And they screwed up so bad. I could go off on this for 20 minutes in a way that I won't. But she has completely unearned character growth, like, on a dime. She's this, like, cynical, like, criminal with no interest in this thing. And then suddenly she's, like, arguing in the council room that rebellions are built on hope, and there's been, like, not a single growth moment. And the closest thing is motivation for her dead dad. So, like, just basically, like, subsuming her entire character within a male character. It sucks. So, when I made Going Rogue, I was almost responsible. When you're doing adaptational media, it's like, okay, I've got to capture her somehow. These playbooks have to represent her. She's core to this thing that I'm trying to adapt and tell. But also, I hate her character. What do I do? And that's where the sort of close reading part of adaptational media steps in. I love close reading things. Like, I have watched Rogue One over and over again and, like, taken notes and, like, focused on different characters and what are they doing and what is that doing for the story. And her playbook is called The Leveraged, because I realized that what I found most interesting about her character was she wasn't participating in this because she wanted to. She was participating in this because the good guys were forcing her to with blackmail. We freed you from prison. Do this or we turn you back in. Was really compelling, actually, especially because both the movie and my game are in many ways about how do these people who are cynics and loners come to be willing to give their entire life for this cause, to sacrifice themselves for this cause. Spoiler warning, Rogue One, a little too late. Sorry about that. And spoiler warning, Going Rogue, part of how it works is that, like, you know at the beginning that all of your characters will die at the end of this game. And it's about playing to find out what makes these playbooks, most of whom are cynics, loners, etc., become willing throughout this process. You've got this dramatic irony of, we know we're going to give our lives for something that moves the universe closer to freedom. Why would I do that? And so for Jyn Erso, I thought the interesting thing is, well, at first someone is forcing her, but there's something she has. In Going Rogue, that playbook has what are two principles that challenge even your cynicism? And it's things like everyone deserves the chance to free themselves or never allow a child to come to harm. These are things that, like, even people who maybe aren't seeing themselves as freedom fighters might still feel personally, that can lead them on this path to realizing, oh, I need to universalize this. This is actually important to me. Unlike Jyn Erso's character, who just, like, suddenly on a dime, her dad dies, and now she's a committed rebel for no reason. I was like, let's take the interesting aspect of her character, throw out everything that I think that sucks, and develop and expand upon that. And so when you have those things that you hate, doing adaptational media lets you, if you're willing to really engage with the text and love a part of it and hate another, bring that part out and get rid of what doesn't work.
I'm reminded of a conversation we had with Banana Chan on the podcast about Banana did the Scooby-Doo Betrayal at House on the Hill. And Banana talked about having to watch so much Scooby-Doo that by the end of it, she didn't really enjoy it anymore. But it sounds like you still have a lot of love for this IP. Like, did making this game affect that at all? Or can you then, like, still turn on Rogue One and, like, have a good time?
Besides the fact that I know all the dialogue front to back, that's the biggest problem. And I hear that with what, like, Banana Chan was going through. Luckily, I'm such a sucker for it. And, like, when you've got something with, like, that good of a score, which, like, music is black magic and everything else, like, you're gonna feel it. I could cry to the scene when Cassian and everyone says, like, if we don't do this, we have nothing else. Like, we have to do this. We've done terrible things for this. We need to see it to completion. Like, I still do think I have that love for it, but I can see how that happens. Yeah.
There's another thing there. I mean, there's so much great stuff you said in there. I just love the framing of you have to hate it and love it. I think that it's one of those things where I think you made me realize something about when I love a game that is an adaptation, whether loose or direct, is that I sit down to play it because I love the thing, but kind of what I end up, why I end up loving the game is because I end up telling a different story, and that's built off of like what I hated about the game. And I think like there's some of that in here of like even the use of belonging outside belonging, which is like a pretty inherently queer system often, like in like Star Wars is like there's not a lot of queerness and stuff. So you end up like, it's like, hey, you're sitting down because you want to tell this type of story, but by the time you get up from the table, you'll be like, actually, I told something way better than Star Wars. Like, forget that.
Absolutely, exactly. That galactic game I was talking about, also called Galpalactic, and it literally, I'm trying to remember the top of our play doc, was something like lesbians in space or whatever. Like, I think we had like one repeat male character and like just a whole bunch of lesbians. So yes, it absolutely gets more queer. And yeah, you get to tell that version of things that doesn't get to be represented on screen, which is like part of what's so exciting about doing this.
There's a thing that we talk about on this show a lot and on My First Dungeon of like having that easily accessible on-ramp for people like to get into a story, and like adaptational media like this, when you have an IP that everyone has a vague understanding of, even if you've never seen Star Wars, you kind of get Star Wars just because it's so in the zeitgeist. And then, you know, there's a whole scale of how much you understand. But having that common place to start from allows you to get so much deeper in a story so much quicker, because you're like, hey, we're not starting at base camp. We're starting in the middle of the mountain. And now we can find our own way to the tippy top of this story. But we don't have to set up all those stakes and world in the way that you have to in something that's a little bit less adaptational or a little bit less specific.
Exactly.
And so I love games that like have that specificity to it.
That's something I think a lot about with I Have the High Ground, actually, because I Have the High Ground is a game where you are doing the pre-battle banter. You are doing like that scene in a movie where two characters are about to duel and they're like bantering back and forth. That's the scene that I Have the High Ground tells. And it can be like any genre, any setting. Like, it's got like a sci fantasy cover, but it's not fundamentally a Star Wars game, and it is not fundamentally a sci fantasy game. I have seen two kindergartners bickering in the hallway before trying out for the solo part in the school play. I've seen neighbor dogs barking over the fence.
That's good too.
We did French rat chefs on Patreon.
Yes, ratatouille. On.
Yeah.
competing ratatouilles.
So it was so funny. I was losing my mind listening to that, Elliot.
Oh, you're brave for listening through mine and Abby's horrific French accents we did for that.
I have my own grudge against the French. It helps that I'm Jewish. And so that was actually great. That was great to me. Anyway, with I Have the High Ground, I'm telling very specific type of scene. I am telling one scene that has a beat-for-beat narrative structure. And it will end always with the loser, because you're playing like rock, paper, scissors as thrust, feint, and parry, which are different types of insult, like an aggressive one, baiting someone, or a witty comeback. And so whoever scores the most points in that rock, paper, scissors, their opponent has to strike the first blow, because they're the one who gets like really fed up and impatient and like looks bad for starting the fight. And so I know everything that is going to happen in your game. I know where it's going to end. And so as the designer, the more restrictions I introduce in that way, the more I can represent things that will happen in that process with fidelity and in interesting ways that like, when you try to make GURPS or whatever that can adapt anything, you have a limitation on what you can actually do with it, because you close off doors that you mean to leave open, or like that might not apply, that might actually get in the way because you're trying to be so flexible. And so I love really specific games, because then you can mechanize things that just aren't possible. And that's the thing that I like, especially people who are developing for the first time and they're doing their big fantasy heartbreaker that's like trying to be D&D. I'm like, just make a 20-page game, pick one thing that you like, and represent it really, really well. And that will teach you so much more. And also your first game will come out so much better, and it'll be easier. But like, it will come out better because you can speak to a very specific experience incredibly well in an innovative way that is not as easy when you're trying to adapt everything And it's also another reason adaptational media is easier. Like, it's easier because you have a reference text, which is, like, hugely helpful. But it's also easier because you've really restricted the story space. And that doesn't exactly mean you've restricted your players either. Because, like we said, like, these systems, Galactic and Going Rogue, are setting you up. But, like, two different universes of Galactic and Going Rogue will look completely different. I've played, like, dozens of Going Rogue one-shots now. And, like, the story of how this political conflict happens and what the fight looks like and why they're doing it and how these characters relate to it can be so, so different as long as players and some elements of the story are inhabiting these general story archetypes. And so I give you those initial setup tools to make sure you're pointed in the right direction. And I tell you, you will end in sacrificing yourself. And there's actually a ton of room to generate different versions of things in between that, like, beginning and end point.
There's a thing in there that is so good and, like, so specific. Like, it applies, the way you applied it to games at large is great, but it's also the way it applies to this adaptational media. The magic of I Have the High Ground as a game to me is that it is an adaptation, but it's an adaptation of this micro piece of Star Wars, of this moment of the, like, literally saying I have the high ground. Like, that's what gets people. But it's like you're showing people that, like, adaptation doesn't mean every bit of plot, every faction, every, like, thing is given a stat block. But what you've done is done, like, a spiritual adaptation. And I'm kind of curious how you think about when in something as small as the I Have the High Ground, and then with these two games, particularly for you with Going Rogue, how do you think about plot and moments that you want to adapt from something you love versus I'm actually more focused on the spirit in this moment?
When I wrote I Have the High Ground, I had not watched Revenge of the Sith since I was a child. It had been over a decade. I thought it was a really clever name, and so I went with it.
You're right.
Thank you. But, like, I was just racking my brain. I did a little less close reading for this one, but I was just racking my brain for every pre-battle banter scene I'd ever seen, which is many. I was trying to adapt a meta-narrative structure more than I was trying to adapt a moment or a scene or a plot. And that's part of what I, like, had so much fun doing with that one. And when it comes to Going Rogue, there are a couple core things I am doing in Going Rogue that I'm actually doing more than I am adapting Star Wars. Like, Star Wars, sure, is the set dressing, and I do take a lot from it. It is a useful thing from which to pull, and Rogue One especially is a useful thing from which to pull. But Going Rogue was written at a time when I was really deeply processing my experience of doing street anti-fascism during the first Trump administration. And I have some design notes in there about that. I can obviously only be so specific about work like that, but I was really processing those feelings and a feeling of, like, did we do anything? Was it worth it? We took some, like, pretty serious risks. And did we accomplish anything? And the thing about real life political organizing is that you don't get an answer to that question. Sometimes you'll get wins that you can, like, count and, like, it seems like a win in the moment, but, like, how much larger difference did that make on a grand historical scale? It's not even that you won't make that difference, it's that you will never know. And something I wanted with Going Rogue was for you as a player to get to experience the bleed of my character comes to realize that this sacrifice matters so much that they are willing to give their life for it because they know. And that, and then even more on top of that, because you know, it says in the sacrifice fate in the book, this will make a difference. You're not allowed to sacrifice yourself for nothing. That's one of the things the rules forbid. And so you get to have that certainty, even if your character doesn't live to see it. And I needed that feeling so badly that creating that feeling, that catharsis, so that hopefully I could take that, like, oh, this is what it's like to know, and hold that with me while I was doing real life organizing work where I didn't get that certainty, was one of the things that I was trying to do. Something else that I was doing was that the book has two pillars that I add to Galactic, or really, like, I split the liberation into the Parliament and the Intelligence. The Parliament being the more, like, democratic faction that is responsible for often public communication and bringing together different coalitions and governing, and the Intelligence being the, like, network of spies and operatives who do the, like, dirty work. Everyone's favorite desire for the Intelligence is to bear the heaviest burden so others don't have to. Everyone chooses it, which I love. And these two are set up in tension. And I specifically say neither of these the bad guy. Both of these are real things a revolutionary movement needs, and both of them can go too far. That when, like, this need for democracy and taking care of people and not exposing people to too much danger and deliberation and discourse is necessary if we're going to be better than what we're replacing, and can slow things down and prevent us from acting. And these people who are like, I don't want oversight, I don't want accountability, I just do my thing, there's some degree that, like, that messy and also, like, sometimes ethically gray, like, we're going to hurt people, we're going to cause collateral damage. Cassian in Rogue One shoots an informant, like a rebel, in the first scene that he's in. That work also does have to be done. And if it gets out of hand, it corrupts the very things that we are, like, believing are different than what we're replacing. And in popular media, the Intelligence always gets demonized, right? Like, you're not allowed to be left-wing and without it being secretly revealed that you're evil and go too far in popular media. Saw Gerrera gets constantly demonized in everything but Andor, kind of. And then on the flip side, my target audience, the type of people who play my games, are, like, going to demonize the Parliament as, like, these discourse liberals or whatever. But something I try and really hit in the book is, they're both good guys and they're both bad guys. And this game is about the tension between them. And part of why I was doing that is because I was really frustrated at leftist organizing. I had just moved from anarchist to communist spaces, both of which had their own different types of dilemmas and their different push-pull on each other. And, like, anti-fascist spaces were, like, all of that together, which is its own nightmare. And so I was like, I'm really frustrated at these people and the way that they are engaging with each other. Let's try and process that frustration in a game and try and, like, lab out what that experience is like so that I can vent that frustration somewhere that isn't the meetings where I'm really mad at someone. So I was doing that. I was doing the, like, I want to feel that satisfaction. And I was doing the, like, there's a playbook in there, the convert, who is someone who has joined the liberation recently and, like, just, like, truly enthusiastically believes, like, to a degree that's a little naive. And then the spy, who's, like, been doing this for so long, they no longer even see a place for themselves in this better world because they're like, well, I've actually awful, but, like, I'll do that so that you all can get there. And these playbooks and all the playbooks are specifically designed. I've, like, looked at every combination and said, how do these pull on each other? How does this spy prepare the convert to, like, accept some of the darker parts of this so that they don't have to, like, have that disappointment and that drop the spy has themselves? And on the flip side, how does the spy see their younger self in the convert and get back in touch with this version of themselves that believed that things could be better, that things are wonderful and there's a place for them? They're striving for something that is beautiful. I had been feeling myself transition from the convert to the spy in my own organizing effort. And I wanted to be reminded. I wanted to step into that role and be reminded and see myself through the eyes of that character. And so as I'm making this game, I'm processing all of these different emotions. And yeah, Rogue One made me feel those emotions when I was in the theater. It's part of why I loved it. But I wanted to inhabit it. I wanted to play and explore so I could feel it. And so if Star Wars and this system that I love provided a great container for that, but that was only so, I wasn't trying to get the plot of Rogue One. I was trying to get the things that Rogue One made me feel because they were so relevant to my life. And Rogue One and the fact that I love science fiction made it a really fun backdrop, made it in some ways the sugar on the pill of exploring these more difficult things that I wanted the game to touch on.
There's, I love that. It's like, it goes back to kind of what you were saying at the beginning of, like, it's the thing you love about a thing that you're like, that comes into play, and the thing you hate, but, like, that element of the thing you love, it feels like an adaptation from somebody is inherently going to also just be like 50% the thing they love, and then 50% a piece of them that is inherent in all art, in all art. It's lovely to see the way those kind of come together, and the way you talk about going rogue. That's just really nice.
The good stuff, at least, is 50-50, yeah. Those two things.
Right, right.
Cyber Plus Punk Overload is the first official expansion for the award-winning, ultra-stylish, rules-light cyberpunk game, Cyber Plus Punk, that is specifically designed for action-packed one-shot sessions. In Cyber Plus Punk, you are a runner, a merc, a criminal, an activist living on the edge and running in the shadows of a gritty, ultra-violent world. Infiltrate a mega prison, escape a bloody reality show, solve a time loop, race vehicles in the Badlands, or escape the Netscape. One-shot scenarios, gear catalogs, plug-in rule sets, and complete settings made by an all-star cast of game designers and stylishly bundled into three sleek thematic packs. So go back Cyber Plus Punk Overload on Kickstarter to get the limited edition version with a slick hollow foil sleeve. Just search CBR plus PNK colon overload on Kickstarter. That's CBR plus PNK colon overload.
The Badlands. Legend has it that beneath the dust, something old and powerful still whispers to any gunslinger foolish enough to listen. One day, aboard a doomed train into the wastes, three unlucky travelers hear that call. A runaway socialite, a shapeshifting bounty hunter, and a retired thief turned family man. Will our outcasts find what they're looking for?
I mean, we're already here, let's have a little fun.
You really went in there, guns blazing.
I thought that was the plan.
My potions are miraculous.
I thought we were being quiet.
Oh, Stump only has one volume, sorry.
Wild roses grow out of his mouth, having filled his lungs.
What's happening out there?
Violence.
Find out on Mage Hand High Five.
So, going rogue is a belonging outside belonging game, and I have the high ground as GMless. Like, what is it about GMless games that you are more drawn to than something, a more like quote unquote traditional GM'd game?
So my most recent game, Planet Fist, is a GM'd game. So I am exploring that space somewhat, but why start with GMless? One, when I was writing these games, I was just playing a lot of GMless games. Why was I doing that? A couple different reasons. One, I had been the forever GM. I've been there. I haven't played D&D in like, probably coming up on a decade, but like from age 16 to age 22, I ran 3.5, just more than I could possibly count. And then I ran a bunch of Shadowrun 5e, which I do still love, but still like, I was a GM for so long that I was just like, okay, I want to play this game. And so it was really appealing to get to do that. Also, the game that broke open TTRPGs for me, the game that made me realize there's a wide world out there, was Avery Alder's The Quiet Year, which has also had an impact on going rogue, just in sort of knowing the tragedy that comes at the end. The Frost Shepherds will come, and you know that that's all of this will be for naught in certain ways, is a huge inspiration. And so I was like, wow, this is amazing. I want to play everything like this. And just going outward from there brought me to a lot of GMless games. But I also think, besides just running away from GM'd games for a while, by the end of our Galactic game that I've talked about a few times, it felt like a writer's room. Like, it was all of us pitching ideas and being like, well, what if it went here? And someone's like, oh, that would be interesting. And I'd love if then we like did this. And it was like, this feeling is amazing. I mean, I love B-movie sci-fi. That's like inspired. That's the biggest impact any media has had on me, is like terrible sci-fi original series is like my whole thing.
Like SYFY series?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. you know, Stargate, I grew up on Stargate SG-1, as problematic as that show is, and like Battlestar Galactica is a huge influence on me, all sorts of, and it gets worse from there. And so that sense of almost like a TV writer's room of we're throwing stuff at the wall, let's see what sticks, let's see how that realizes it, is actually way more fun to me some of the time than it is to imagine either I am a storyteller putting a story out and then you're interacting with it, or I am a player exploring this sandbox. This feeling of we are working together to tell the story that is most interesting for us to tell, and like pitching and bouncing off each other, like that's actually really compelling to me. And I have learned with time that sometimes that's hard. GMless games are hard. They just are hard. They're hard to play. They ask a lot of everyone, because when one person sort of has central narrative agency, not to say they don't give it out, but when someone is meeting out that narrative agency, there's a lot less communication and like back and forth and like giving and taking space that you need to do. Not that there's ever none, but it's just way easier than like, well, the four of us have to come to a collective unanimous decision on what we're doing here.
It is easier when like in any game, if you get to a point, no matter how much push and pull there is, if you just kind of get tired and can just turn to one person and say, can I do it or not? There is like a release valve in that where like, okay, I don't have to be on for a moment. I can put that burden on someone else. And with GMless games, you don't have any room to hide there. You're always active.
And so I have come back around because of that reason. But like there was a 2-year period, I don't think I played a GM'd game because I was just so like, I'm free. I'm free from the world of having to be a forever GM. I'm exploring these feelings of these like open collaborative writers' rooms. And now that I've come back to GM'd games, it's also changed how I look at those. Like when I GM a game, or especially I feel like the worst player, but the GMs I work with love it. I'm like, could I actually step in and play that NPC? Or like, what if this is where this went? Like, I'm backseat GMing a little bit, but in a way that when you have a table of people who play GMless games, like, can become appreciated. You can see that there's actually room to backport that onto GM'd games. And so, yeah, I think the desire to get away from that responsibility, which I've also done now by moving to systems that don't put as much responsibility on the GM as 3.5 or Shadowrun, shout out Mothership, then the desire to have that collaborative feeling was really, I think, what inspired me and drew me to GMless games. Also, with I Have the High Ground, it was about it being a 2-player game. Like, I was playing a lot of 2-player games with my collaborator, Seda, who I met in that Galactic game. And I Have the High Ground actually comes out of, in many ways, it was a side game of that Galactic game. We were taking our characters and like bringing them into another system and telling out a like alternate universe version of these characters using Riley, actually another of Riley's games. It's been a long time coming, and it's been a long, long time. One of them is like a GMless 2-player storytelling game about two people who like really like loved each other and had this connection and then were apart for a long time and then get this reunion. And the other is like a Javert and, oh God, I don't know what I miss.
Javert?
Javert and a person, other character. This is embarrassing. We're going to get torn up in the comments.
I feel like I was just going to say a random French name if I tried.
Well, anyway, it's two people who had this rivalry and then are apart for a very long time and then like come back together for a fated duel. These characters that we were playing were enemies to lovers. And so we mashed up both of Riley's games into a single one, both of them at once. And in so doing, we end up changing the structure where we're like, that game is you draw from a deck and it asks you a question and you answer a prompt that is like, you're not jumping into dialogue. Riley hates doing dialogue. You're not jumping into dialogue. You're just answering like, what is true about our relationship? How did this happen? Talk about the story, the arc of it. We like took the questions just naturally, took the questions as prompts that then inspired the dialogue that each question would give us. So one of us would draw, the other of us would draw, our character would talk, and we'd talk about something that would tell the story of that question. And I was like, oh, I love this, because it's making it so much easier to do really in-depth improvised dialogue for this scene, because it is structuring that dialogue. And like usually doing like a really long, intense dialogue scene improvisationally can be really hard. And so I loved having the talk for a little bit. When you're not sure what else to say, draw a card and it'll tell you what to talk about. And that structure becomes I Have the High Ground, because it is now like play rock, paper, scissors. And it tells you whose insult lands and what the insult they're talking with is. And so bringing this all the way back around, two-player games lend themselves really well to GM-less play, because it's a little more difficult for one player to like operate in this GM space, though not impossible, but also because like you're almost inherently GM-less in a two-player game, even when you're playing it GM'd. You are always saying something to a person, and that person is saying something back to you. And like there is this constant expectation of anything I do, you have to respond to, which is very different than there is a GM at the center, they put out a situation, and whoever wants to can jump in. It's a very different experience, even if you're just playing with a player and a GM. And so we were playing so many two-player games together, and also it's just so much easier to schedule two-player games that I end up playing a lot of two-player games, and then I end up playing a lot of GM-less games.
I'm curious to bring this all the way back to the beginning, how GM-less versus GM, does the decision plays into adaptational media for you? Like, what is there? Do you think one is better for adaptation at large, or is it very what you're adapting specific for you?
That's a great question. I've never really thought about it. I would say, I mean, in many ways, this comes back to what do you love about the piece of media? And so I suppose that does make it media specific, but it's even less media specific. It's about what do you want to capture in that thing? And I think it's also the case that, as with I Have the High Ground, that scene makes sense as that type of scene makes sense as two players, which makes it lend itself to GM-less. And my Planet Fist is also a adaptational piece of media. It is really a pretty direct rip on PlanetSide 2, the like MMO FPS, which like not many people are familiar with. It is also very Starship Troopers. It came out before Helldivers, but an article got written about how it's the Helldivers 2 game because it's that theme and that way of engaging. And that's GM'd, but it was GM'd more because I was looking to tell this, like, I call it a narrative war game. It's a very strange game that I would have to explain, but like the whole game takes place in combat. And like, I wanted to like set up obstacles and have you fighting them. And so in that way, adapting an MMO FPS was a little bit easier to do when you have someone setting up a puzzle of obstacles and controlling the other team versus like, you all have to collectively control your enemies. Whereas going rogue, I'm trying to capture the writer's room. And like, it was inspired by Rogue One, but I like television more than movies. So I'm always going for the like television writer's room feeling. And so someone who wants to adapt Star Wars, but what's important to them is the story of a lone hero who like goes out and trains with their mentor and then like faces the big bad at the end. Maybe that would lend itself more to a GM'd game in the way that like these characters get to be these big heroes who are overcoming these external challenges, this like man versus world or man versus man. But what Riley was doing is, I like the relationships between the good guy protagonists or whatever. I like how they're messy and difficult. I want to capture that. And then the world is there for them to bounce those relationships off of and to like challenge them. And I think that makes more sense in many ways as a GM-less game, where you are all sharing this responsibility in the same way that your characters are sharing these relationships. And so it is, I would say it's less about adaptational media and less about the individual piece of media and much more about what are you trying to capture in that media.
I have a question, again, this is kind of moving a little bit away from the creative space and getting more into the Kickstarter and some of like a production question I have for Galactic and Going Rogue, is these are two games. They're incredibly linked by subject matter and vibe. But what was the impetus for you guys putting them as two games into a single book? I know this has been done a couple times with like Venture Dungeon, Dream Askew, Dream Apart, but it's not a super common thing. Why was that the move for you guys?
It's not super common, but it is worth saying the two games that you named, I was about to name, because Dream Askew, Dream Apart is the one that made the Belonging Outside Belonging engine that we're using. And Venture and Dungeon Riley did one of those. Riley did Venture and J-Dragon did Dungeon. And so this is actually very familiar territory for our specific precedent. It's actually very well precedented for our very narrow niche. And on top of that, I literally sent out an email on Itch today, so I'm going to embarrass myself in front of everyone that, I joke trait, which is a mechanic, accountable, and offer a mea culpa. I marketed Going Rogue 2E as, like, its own game. I say it, like, expands upon the original Going Rogue, which was this jam expansion, into its own game. And it does in many ways, because something I discovered about Going Rogue is that you can't just fit its playbooks into the base game. It doesn't work, and you can't play base game playbooks with it. I very specifically architected, like I said earlier, the character relationships between these playbooks to make them... This is a game with a lot of character conflict, a lot of, like, your PCs don't like each other at the beginning, which is difficult to do, and I have very specific narrative structures in place to create the possibility of connection across those differences. And so when you mix in stuff from the base game and playbooks, you're missing those tools that these really need to go in the direction they want to go. So it was its own thing. It completely replaced all the playbooks. It, like, split one of the core book pillars, but it also wasn't. It uses three of the four pillars that the base game uses, the mandate, the liberation, the space between, which I had Riley's permission to include in the play kit, and I did. And it also uses all 36, like, traits, which are, like, little groups of NPC moves, which I didn't bundle in Going Rogue because I felt bad at the idea of asking Riley, can I just take your work and sell it myself? And I didn't rewrite the instructions fully. I wrote, like, a ton of tips, but I didn't, like, fully go through setup. I just sort of assumed you know how this works. And so my message to everyone was, someone asked me for, like, I thought this was his own game. Why didn't I have traits? And I sent them all the traits and I went, you're right. Mea culpa. I probably shouldn't have marketed it that way if I'm going to not include those. And I got Riley's permission to bundle them all in. And I've updated Going Rogue 2E with, like, all the traits and, like, Riley's entire setup section to say, like, here's what you should have been receiving. And at that point, like, they should be in one book. Like, at the point where they do have those links, why try and reprint part of Galactic when you can just recognize that these are operating off the same core engine, but filling the slots of sort of, like, the game content and story specifics in different ways? You can just put them in one book. That's what Dream Askew, Dream Apart did for that reason. And it's also coming from the fact that Riley and I have just been collaborators for a really long time now. We've marketed these games, getting more into the production and business. Like, we've marketed these games together for a long time now. Like, anytime I launched something or had a promotion, it was always a bundle with both Galactic and Going Rogue. Like, we haven't made a promotion for one of them that didn't have both in, like, 3 years. And it just, so it made business and financial sense to do it this way. And it would just be easier. It would bring in both of our audiences, which is also really nice. So yeah, I think there was just a bunch of ways it made logistical and mechanical and financial and business sense to bundle them together.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah. It's one of the things I recently wrote an article for our newsletter about the A Land Once Magic crowdfunding that I did, where I published Viditya's game. And, like, one of the key learnings of that funding is that collaborating and combining somebody's audience with your own is just, like, not a cheat code, because it's still a lot of, you know, work. But, like, it does make that onerous task of kickstarting and crowdfunding just that little bit easier when you've got two people's audiences that you can, like, bother and talk to for a month. So totally get it.
Yeah, it almost becomes multiplicative. It's very, very, very helpful. I was also literally talking to Viditya about some of this at Breakout Con. Viditya was talking about, like, having you publish A Land Once Magic, because in this crowdfunder, I am one of the co-creators of the game, but I am also the publisher. So I have Jumpgate Games, which for a long time was just, like, my, like, moniker to publish my games under, so I could operate my sole proprietorship under a fictitious name. And I called it a publishing imprint for me. And it still is, because, God, I don't want to become a publisher. But it is now an LLC. And in Galactic and Going Rogue, the business arrangement is, we're really into the gritty here, I am the publisher taking on all of the risk of the like flat costs and then getting all of the profit, and then both Riley and I are paid royalties on sales. And so I am paid two different ways. One as Jumpgate Games LLC and one as co-creator. And all everyone involved is like everyone working on the books is getting royalties. But like Riley and I split the biggest share, and then I get the publisher profits because Riley is now a full-time pharmacist and does not have time to run a crowdfunder. And this is my full-time gig. Games are what I do now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It is very exciting. And also, oh God, back Galactic and going rogue, because this one has to pay off. We are
for real
over budget and it's a big investment. but we're excited about that. Like, we're getting to do some really cool stuff. We have over 30 contributors that I'm paying for this project, which is
wild and very exciting.
Thank you.
That's the best bit of like doing like I know you said you don't want to become a publisher, and I've said that same sentence, but then like Being the publisher of a thing. Well, then I became a publisher, and then like getting to pay people, like getting to pay all these cool people rules, getting to like cut a check, metaphorically cut a PayPal to like people who for like what they're best at is like the greatest feeling ever.
Yeah, the combination of getting to pay really cool people and getting to have really cool people adding to your work is absolutely amazing. Like David's covers, David Bednar is doing all the covers and most of the interiors, and it's just like unbelievably gorgeous. And Woshi is doing the layout, and I'm just like, every time I show it to people, they're like, what? This is so cool. And like Riley and I published these games with our layouts and Affinity publisher that are truly terrible, and they're black and white, and they're no art. We didn't know what we were doing. And so getting to see these games transform into something that is the creative labor of other very talented people is so cool. Also getting to pay people who've like, there are people who have just been ride or die for this game since no one had heard of it. Like playing it on podcasts, like thank Dusty Hill, thank you so much. You've been like promoting this thing since like the beginning of time, and it rules. And like Seda, who I've mentioned a couple times, like design consulted on Going Rogue, edited and design consulted and wrote on the Scum and Villains expansion, which is like a stretch goal. We're gonna have a stretch goal to bring that to print. It's another Galactic expansion I did, and like has worked on all of my games and edited like podcasts, and being able to be like, hi, all of this incredible labor you've done that's made all my games better. They're playing like seven roles on the Kickstarter. It's crazy. Being able to then say, I now get to actually pay you in the way that you should have been for this work. It's just an amazing feeling. I get all of the benefit of all of these people's incredible work, and I get to thank them for everything they've done, even when I couldn't actually like pay in the way that hopefully this Kickstarter will allow me to.
I love that. So as we sort of, we're starting to bring this conversation to a close, I want to bring back in this adaptational idea and talk about production here, because there's a lot of amazing things people can get when they support this game. Like you talked about production, and like now you get to make this into like a beautiful thing with all these contributors. How has this idea of making something adaptational translated now to physical production? And also while you're doing that, tease to people what they can get on the Kickstarter.
That is a good question in a lot of different ways, because one, we're not using any Disney IP, but Disney, please don't pay attention to this large crowdfunder that is very inspired by Star Wars. We'll find out. Hopefully Bob Iger or whatever his name isn't listening to Talk of the Table.
I don't think he's a Talk of the Table fan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bob, if you're listening, let us know. Hit us up.
Yeah. And it's also complicated by the fact that we found out like a month into working on this crowdfunder that Disney Plus had been placed on the BDS list. And so, yeah, by the way, if you're watching the season of Andor, absolutely do not subscribe to Disney Plus to do so. It is on the BDS list. It is like basically they're on their priority target list specifically. This is the sort of bare minimum and type of targeted boycott that is most important that we really have to abide by to be in solidarity with people who are suffering a genocide at the hands of Israel. And so we also had to figure out, like, how does our crowdfunder relate to that? We've got a BDS statement on the page, and we will be putting it with everything that we promote, because we are kind of saying, hey, if you like Andor, you'll like this. But also, by the way, we say on there, like, Riley and I do not condone buying Disney Plus to watch Andor this season. And so being adaptational media and running a business is really tricky right now, which is why how I think this relates to your question. And so we're navigating that as best we can. And yeah, we just want to, like, at the very minimum, use our platform for awareness about this thing and say, like, you should know this. Like, we're going to get a lot of Andor fans' eyes on this. And hopefully we can also be saying, don't do this thing. And separately from that, the sort of more fun parts of your question, we get to bring a lot of new parts of this world and ways of experiencing it to the physical product, because we're going to have the rule book, but we're also doing a setting supplement, Look Up to the Stars, Stories from a Different Galaxy. And that's going to have, if we hit all our stretch goals, 7 different authors, me writing a foreword, and then 6 authors who take the game's pillars, those setting elements, and choose some desires, things those pillars want, and make an in-universe document that, like, displays a version of that world. And so, like a memo or like a manifesto, like your classic Memex manifesto, right? Because it's meant to demonstrate, how do you take this generic thing like we talked about and turn it into your version of the game world? This doesn't have to be your one, but we're going to say at the beginning of each little piece of short fiction, here's the desires this author chose. Now look at how they manifest in the world. Now choose your desires and do something similar. Or if you want, you can use it as a prop, right? You can, like, say, like, here's a document that you get handed. So, like, either way you want to do it. But, like, it was interesting for this game to try and find things that stretch goal contributors could do, because we don't want to overly prescribe story. I can't tell someone to just do a module. And going rogue is a pretty, like, focused, I'm very, like, parsimonious about, like, what actually gets to be in the book, because it's telling something very specific and very contained. But we realized it would be so fun to get to see these people's takes on their arguments with Star Wars. That's what I really want in this book, is, like, every one of these authors to, like, get in an argument with the text, which everyone I've talked to has been so exciting. And we have some really cool people doing it. Geeta Jackson from Aftermath is going to be writing one. A stretch goal for Jason Morningstar, who is a designer of Fiasco and Night Witches. Yeah, is specifically doing the intelligence, the, like spies killer, which is so good. Like, Jason Morningstar's, I had the chance to talk with him about Winterhorn, which is a LARP in which you play as a 3-letter intelligence agency trying to take down a left-wing organization as a way of, like, there's a workshop version for, like, learning security culture through inhabiting the opposition. And I was like, okay, we're playing in some spaces that we clearly understand each other. It was so exciting to have him come on for the intelligence. David Bednar, our cover artist, is writing a story. Katrina Dennis, who's, like, Star Wars fanfic, is amazing. Aaron Lim, who does, like, amazing games. Salva, who's, like, a friend of Riley's and has been playing, like, Riley's games from the beginning. Just, like, a really great list of people. And then it'll be edited by Seda. Like I said, Seda's doing, like, 40 roles. And we'll even have a stretch goal for Fiona Howitt for What Am I Rolling to turn it into an audiobook, which I'm really excited about. I really hope we hit that stretch goal.
That's very fun. Oh, dope. Really dope.
So yeah, you can get that book, and you can get I Have the High Ground with a Kickstarter exclusive cover made by David so that it goes with all the other books. It'll be the same cover artist for, you can, like, get a book set that comes with the core book, Look Up to the Stars, and I Have the High Ground, all with covers by David, which is
I'm looking
really
at the
exciting.
Cover right now on your press kit, and it's really nice.
It's so
it's
sick.
Really nice. I want it.
It's really good. I want it.
The inspiration I gave to him was, I was like, if this lands for you, I Have the High Ground's original black and white cover is, like, looking over the shoulder of one character holding a sword out, and then the other character is holding a sword looking up at them on these catwalks. And I wanted an homage to the original cover, and so I told David, can you flip it? Can we look over the shoulder of the other character looking up at the character whose shoulder we were seeing? And then I said, as far as vibe, what I'm looking for is Full Metal Alchemist. Full Metal Alchemist. And I was like, does that land for you? The, like, pre-commercial break, post-commercial break, Full Metal Alchemist difference, where it's, like, kind of two different takes, wow, often on the same piece of art, but, like, with the different vibes. And David was like, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes, I can do that. And then I think he knocked Full Metal Alchemist out of the park.
That slaps.
It was really
great,
fun.
What a great point of inspiration there. That's so good.
That's really good. Ugh, Jess, what are you doing to me? I'm gonna have to get the book set, and I should not spend that money, but I'm going to have to.
I really appreciate that. One of the reasons we're offering the book set is that, like, with the tariffs especially, it's all books. So in theory, it won't be tariffed. And in theory, we can also, in the US, ship media mail. So we're trying to keep shipping costs as low as possible for everyone with the book set, because we've also got a box set. And the box set comes with some really cool things too, like custom dice with art by Luna P, who is fantastic. 25 engraved metal tokens with symbols representing each of the games. And what else do we have? Oh, playing cards with the traits from the book on them. 44 playing cards, so you can like randomly draw an NPC's traits at the table. Playmats for the different pillars, so you can like set them on the table. If you've ever played a Belonging Outside Belonging game and are just like shuffling like 8 different playbooks and pillars and sheets of paper and stuff, we're going to put the pillars on playmats, especially because Galactic and Going Rogue do a really cool innovation of Riley's, which is that pillars or setting elements can have tokens and they participate in the token economy. So you can just take these metal tokens and set them on these like playmats that you've got seated around the table. And so really excited about the box set, but also we don't know what tariffs are going to do there. We don't know how shipping is going to be. So it was really important to me that we offered a tier that was like all the books, all the things you really need to play it, and as cheap as I can possibly get the shipping.
Man, yeah. So yeah, if you're hearing this, and we're going to say it again at the end, but go check out this Kickstarter and then and help make all this like cool ass ambitious stuff happen, because I want to see all this shit made real. It's awesome.
Thank you. It is going to be so cool. We've been working on these games for the better part of 4 years, and seeing them in print is going to be so, so lovely. And even just, we announced this week that we're recording this, and seeing the like outpouring of excitement from like the community and people who have been playing these games, like we've sold 2,300 copies of this on Itch.
Oh, wow.
And another part of how this happened, you asked me how we knew, why did we print these together? How did that idea happen? We aren't the only ones with that idea. We have comments on Itch and tweets that we've seen of Galactic Going Rogue should really like be in print. They should just print them in one book. We got asked on Itch like a month ago, have you considered printing Galactic and Going Rogue in like a shared book? And we're like, buddy, we are considering it so hard. I promise you, you'll hear.
We're considering it left. We're considering it right. We're considering it all over the fucking place.
Yeah. So yeah. Shout out, audience. Say that stuff to designers, because that was motivating. As was I played Going Rogue on A More Civilized Age, the like Star Wars actual play and Natalie. Which, by the way, Austin and Natalie are coming back for an official actual play for this. It's going to be feed dropping on One Shot. By the time you're hearing this, it might be out, 2 episodes. And yeah, part of how that happened is literally we saw a tweet from someone Riley and I did not know saying that I would love to see the AMCA crew play Galactic or Going Rogue with Riley and Jess. And we were like, that's such a great idea. Let's send that to Austin and be like, hey, would you want to do this? Then Austin was like, yeah, post Andor, absolutely, let's do it. And so, like, tell creators that you are fans of what you want from their work, because knowing that interest is there is actually a huge motivator. We literally sent a screenshot of that tweet.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's going to be an exciting campaign. You got a lot of great stuff planned. And that's one of 2 major actual plays you've got going, yeah?
Yes, yeah, we're doing one for Galactic and one for Going Rogue, somewhat naturally. So, yes, Austin is facilitating the one on One Shot, and that's also got Dylan, the host of One Shot, Kendrick Smith, Kendo Makes Films, and Seda is both performing and editing in that actual play. And then for Galactic, Jeff Stormer is facilitating, who like has been ride or die for these games always, and who's just truly an incredible facilitator. And performing, we've got Katrina Dennis, Dusty Hill, Nala J. Wu, and Ify Nwadiwe, which was very exciting and very wild for me to book, so that was very fun. The actual plays have been the hardest part of this production process, actually. And so I really hope people listen and enjoy them. But also, I think they came out really fantastic. People did such cool things with the system. And there's something so rewarding about seeing someone take your system and turn it into this amazing story.
Jess, as we kind of move to a close here, we have one last question that we like to ask everyone who comes on this show. And that is, what are you bringing to the table? This is just our cute way of asking you for a recommendation of absolutely anything. It could be a person, place, a game, a show, a resource. It could be inside of tabletop, outside of tabletop. What would you like to bring to the table?
In this case, I'm going to go back to Seda again, because they have a project that they are working on that I am so excited about. It's a game that's been out, but they are bringing it to a new form. It's called Hook, Line, and Cyber. Hook, Line, and Cyber.
Great name.
Yeah, it's so So many things I'm about to say are clever about this. It was originally for Fishblade Jam. If someone doesn't know what Fishblade Jam is, there's this joke tweet about, like, people will be like, play a game other than D&D, and then they'll introduce you to a game called Fishblade, where you're a fish with a blade tied to their head.
Great game.
Yeah. Great. And someone was like, okay, yeah, absolutely. Let's do Fishblade Jam. It's got to be about fish and blade. So Seda took this and decided it would be a game whose mechanics were go fish, and blade would help represent what your character archetype was in a cyberpunk heist setting. So you could be a rollerblade, a blade of grass, a shoulder blade.
Oh, no.
And there was one more blade that I'm forgetting. Incredible interpretations of this. And so what you essentially do, it's like reverse Fiasco in a lot of ways, where you're trying to pull off these cyberpunk heists. And you do that by completing a set of cards in Go Fish. So when you get to four cards, you pull off the job. If you stole that card from someone's hand rather than like drawing it from the deck, you stole the job out from under them. It's like somewhat competitive. You're four different independent operators. And so you like steal the job they're trying to do. And each card represents a detail of that job. So it's like a client or an in or an objective or something like that. And there are these crazy tables. It is massively inspiring to my own work. It is the coolest use of tables I've ever seen that just like generate 80 million different ways you could have like a piece of a cyberpunk setting. And so in Fiasco, you have these random tables of objects and then you're forming character relationships out of them. In Hookline and Cyber, you complete a book and you have four totally randomly generated details from the four cards. And then you make sense of them when you complete the book. It's like, how do these four things fit together? What is the narrative here? What job happened? And you play Go Fish until you've done all the jobs. And then in the end, you have a climactic one last job scene where what happens to your character is determined by which books, which collections of Go Fish cards you collected during the game. It is just like absolutely bananas play experience, hilarious and really fun and clever. And they're making it into a pamphlet format right now. Maybe that'll be out by the time this is happening, but they're turning, it's like a 5.5 by 8.5 zine that they are miraculously editing down into two pamphlets, one with like the generators and one with the core rules. And it's just sick as hell. And I really recommend people check it out.
I love mechanics like that. That's so good.
That is so smart.
So cool. They've done both Go Fish and a game powered by a cootie catcher. It's like about like the validating intelligence in a cyberpunk setting. Like you're getting like rumors and have to validate them. And whether or not they are true is based on the outcome of the cootie catcher. And you fold the rules. It's a one page game that you fold the rules into the cootie catcher.
That's and so good.
Everything you need to play literally fits on the strip on the side that you cut off to turn it into a square that can fold so that you still have the rules. It's Seda's work is amazing.
That fucking slaps. Wow.
We're going to link that too. What's that one called?
Slender Threads of Freaks and Fortune. Freaks are F-R-E-Q-S frequencies because you're like listening in.
Man, do you ever hear somebody make something and you just get angry at how good it is? Because I'm having that.
It's so clever. I take Slender Threads of Freaks and Fortune to every convention with me because it is the perfect way to get people to the table because it's a one pager that I hand away for free. And I say, do you want a free game? And then I show them the cootie catcher and they lose their mind. And it's just such an amazing, amazing way to get people's interest.
Damn it. We'll put it in the show notes. Go click
it'll
on
be
it.
In the show notes. Go check it out.
Jess, thank you so much for coming to the show. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you?
And one more time, where they can find your Kickstarter.
So I am Jess from online, so I'm very easy to find online. And what I mean by that is literally go on Blue Sky and type at jessfrom.online or go to the URL jessfrom.online and you will find all of my stuff. If you're only interested in my games and not my other work, because I'm also an author and a musician, but if you're only interested in my games, you can go to jumpgate.games and that'll have all of that for you. You can sign up for my mailing list, which is super helpful for me. And most importantly, you can find links to the Kickstarter on every one of the places I just mentioned. This is the only thing I'm talking about for the next 2 months. Mute me now, Tyler Creator Voice. You can also find it at kickstarter.com/galacticgoingrogue.
And if you want more gaming content from us here at Talk of the Table, you can check out the Many-Sided newsletter or become a member of the Many-Sided Media Discord, or you can choose to support this show and the other stuff that we make on the Many-Sided Media Patreon. Those are all going to be linked in our show notes below.
As always, please rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.